This is the second in the series, U.S. Foreign Policy at the Crossroads. My name is Joel Muggy. I'm the director of the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And the title of this session is The Philippines, Farce and Ferment. I'll talk a little bit about that title in a minute. This session, or this series, is an attempt to look at U.S. foreign policy, for those of you that weren't here the first session, in three distinct areas of the world where we find ourselves in crisis. And when me, I mean not only the people of the region, but it's a situation in which the United States is also embroiled in one way or another. These also happen to be three areas of the world where the Center for Global Education does educational travel seminars. So much of what I'm going to share with you today comes out of the experience of many of our groups and our staff people working in the region, as we have had an opportunity to talk with, share with a wide range of people at every level of the social and political spectrum in the countries that are involved. So that's the kind of setting in which we're, sort of the framework out of which I'm going to be speaking today. Also, in each session, I'm trying to look a little bit at the historical situation, the shape of the current crisis, and the way in which U.S. foreign policy is involved. And lastly, I just want to make my typical apology here for really trying to deal in each session with some very complex topics. It's almost an insult to the countries and the peoples involved to deal, to try to talk about one an hour. It's sort of ridiculous to try to do it, but what we'll try to do is hit the broad themes. And then on Saturday, if those of you who are here and can come, we'll talk about sort of what are some of the threads that run through all three areas. And that probably is already evident to some of you. The title of today's presentation, The Philippines, Farce and Ferment, was actually a title that I borrowed from an article in the most recent newsletter of the Center for Global Education, an article written by Catherine Inoferio, our staff person who deals primarily with the Philippines. In that article, she describes an opening line of an article in the May issue of The Economist. It's hard to take the Philippines seriously. Loyal soldiers play pop records to persuade rebel colleagues to surrender. Communist insurgents sell safe conduct passes to anti-communist politicians. Mrs. Imelda Marcos had a pair of disco shoes with rechargeable lights in the heels. And it's true that events and personalities in the Philippines can often top the finest fiction. Filipinos have an unmistakable sense of flair and drama and an indomitable spirit of celebration. Perhaps the best example of it, and here's where I should have a slide, is of what's known in the Philippines as the jeepney. The jeepney is the primary means of transportation throughout the country and certainly in the city. There's some buses, but mostly jeepneys, which are jeeps, sort of an extended body that hold about 10 people, and they're painted and decorated in the wildest colors imaginable. I mean, every jeepney is unique. There's not one jeepney in the country that's identical to another. And with that sense of almost a farcical nature about it. We all know, I think, by now, some of the wild stories about Imelda. Not only her 3,000 pairs of shoes, but all of the things that, the kind of the wild things she was associated once. When I was in the Philippines once before, Marcos's overthrow, there was a report in the paper about Imelda speaking to a group of urban poor. And just to say that the kind of almost comical twist, she was talking about how she identified with the poor because she was one of the poor herself. She was grew from the poor. And then the newspaper columnist said, she quoted her and then said, she said, as the sunlight sparkled off her diamond earrings, you know, it was that sort of ironic twist. Well, sparkle is very much part of the Philippines. And I think, indeed, as many of us watched the February Revolution a little over two years ago, which, you know, was the first many of us even began to realize, I think, that the Philippines were an entity somewhere, I think we wondered if we were really seeing a fiesta or the overthrow of a dictator. And perhaps in many respects it was both. But looking past the events and the personalities to the larger issues and trends and to the people affected by them, it's easy to take the Philippines very seriously. And I think perhaps we haven't taken the Philippines seriously enough. Certainly our government has, but we as the North American people have not. There's a sense in which, of the three areas that I'm going to be dealing with this week, I think the Philippines is the area we're least familiar with in our media, in our history, and so forth. And yet it's ironic that for the Philippines, probably none of the three areas is closely connected in its history as the Philippines is to us and us to them. The Philippines, just one example, I'm not sure about this. I know the Filipino population in this country is one of the largest immigrant populations in this country, and I think it may be the largest, which is always a surprise, but it's one of the largest. There's a very large Filipino presence in this country, and the links between our countries are substantial. And for that reason, I think it's very, very important that we deal with it. Beneath this sometimes comic facade that I've just portrayed to you a little bit of, lie a people struggling for land, for sovereignty, dignity, and freedom from violence. This hit home to me very dramatically about 3 years ago at the end of my very first trip to the Philippines. This was before the overthrow of Marcos. My plane had just taken off from Manila Airport, bound for Tokyo, the first stop home on a after what had been a very successful planning trip for me, because we were then, it was a planning trip to do a number of travel seminars to the Philippines, which we have subsequently done. I just settled back in my seat, opened a book, and almost without warning, my eyes just filled with tears, and I found myself just weeping uncontrollably. It was as if all of a sudden, all of the experiences of the previous week were flooding back over me. All of the suffering, the joys, the hopes, and struggles of the Filipino people that I had been privileged to share in that week. And if you know me, you know that doesn't happen very often for me, to weep uncontrollably. Those experiences were demanding more of me than just a safe intellectual response. And it was not as either the pain or the spirit of hope that I had encountered in the Philippines were new to me, because I had been in Latin America, and again, that had brought me face to face with the stark realities of those who live in situations of poverty and oppression. But I think maybe I'd gradually begun to insulate myself from those realities after time going to the region, and perhaps protect myself a bit from really being touched by those experiences. And I left Manila that time being deeply moved by the gentle, gracious courage of the Filipino people. And those defenses came tumbling down again. And each time I leave the Philippines now, there's a little bit of that experience that's still there that touches me. For the rest of that trip home, and for several days after my return, the tears were seldom very far from the surface. And many images of the Philippines continued to haunt me during that time, and still do today. Each time I go back, those images are very real. And I want to share three images with you that I think will set the framework a little bit for our discussion today. These are images, I think, I was thinking about these this morning during Dan's presentation, where he's talking about the principalities and the powers. The first two of these, at least, are an example of what he was talking about, I think, in the principalities and the powers. The first is a mountain. I'm afraid it's not a mountain like the mountains around Holden Village. It's called Smoky Mountain. This Smoky Mountain is hardly covered with snow, as the familiar ballad goes. It's a mountain of garbage, about a mile in diameter, pushed up against the shores of Manila Bay by the sprawling slums of Metro Manila. It gets its name from the many fires that smolder on its shoulders, slopes that are homes to thousands of Filipinos who try to survive each day by reclaiming what they can from the tons of garbage added to the mountain each and every day. There are no resources to send the children to school, so they play in the garbage, naked children with bloated stomachs, and many other signs of malnutrition and disease. And as I walked through the stench and the smoke, which was made even stronger by the tropical heat, it's very, very hot in the Philippines, it was all I could do to keep from vomiting, and many people who have that experience do. Never before had I experienced anything that could be called, come closer to being called a living hell. And yet for these people, the level of desperation is so great that a victory for them would be to be allowed to stay there and not be moved off the mountain by those who would like to develop the area. That's a victory because there's nowhere else for them to go. Smoky Mountain is just one example of the desperate poverty in which the majority of the over 50 million Filipino people live. It's estimated that 70% of the 50 million people are in desperate poverty. The second image I have was of a city. The city is called Olongapo. If any of you were ever in the Navy and served in the Pacific, you know Olongapo. Olongapo is nestled on the shores of a beautiful bay and nestled as well at the edge of the largest U.S. naval installation outside of the U.S., Subic Naval Base. Subic Base and nearby Clark Air Base are garrisoned for about 15,000 U.S. military and Defense Department personnel. Subic is also strongly suspected of being one of the main storage areas for nuclear arms in the Pacific. And both of these facts contribute to the strong resistance to U.S. military presence among many of the Filipino people, who fear that this presence makes them a primary target for a potential major international conflict, especially the presence of nuclear weapons. But even deeper reasons for the resentment are evident in the relationship of Olongapo City to Subic Naval Base. A relationship that I think is in many ways symbolic of the Philippines' relationship to the United States in general. For Olongapo City exists for the sole purpose of serving the U.S. Naval Base. One of the ways it serves is as a, quote, rest and recreation, unquote, center for Subic personnel as well as for the sailors of the 7th Fleet. Now what this really means is quickly revealed when you walk down the main street of Olongapo. Especially on a typical evening when a carrier is in port. Hundreds of prostitutes hawk their services from the doorways and sidewalk tables of countless massage parlors and bars. Billboards and neon signs throw things at you, like one of them that I remember most is the coldest beer and the hottest women in town. Of Olongapo's population of 200,000 people, it's estimated that 25,000 are prostitutes. 16,000 of them are registered. Most of them poor women from rural areas who have turned to prostitution out of desperation. They have nowhere else to turn. In this environment, as you can imagine, problems of drug abuse, alcoholism, venereal disease, and suicide can reach almost epidemic kinds of proportions. And I think the most tragic outgrowth or the product of this principal industry is the hundreds of Amerasian children who roam Olongapo and are raised in this world of sex and violence and ultimately become its next victims. But there's a second way that Olongapo City serves the base, and that's by supplying nearly 16,000 civilian workers on the base itself, which supplement the U.S. military and U.S. civilian personnel on the base. Now, the Navy likes to portray itself as a benefactor, providing jobs helping the economy. But it doesn't take many conversations with Filipino workers on the base to recognize who is serving whom. U.S. Citizens make dramatically higher salaries than Filipino workers doing the same thing. In fact, many workers talked about the fact that high school-aged children of U.S. personnel at home during the summer from school, wherever they are, make more per hour on a summer job program than do Filipino workers, a Filipino foreman, for example, who's been working for many years. And all the policies which affect salaries and so forth are made in Honolulu with no input from the people who are earning them. So a Longapo, I think, is a testimony to U.S.-Filipino relationships in many ways. Finally, a more hopeful image, a young man, a man whose insight and experience outstretched his years. He was my guide in the Philippines on that first trip, and who in the course of helping me understand the Philippines became a friend. His patience, his commitment to justice, his spirit of hope, and sort of the gentle, caring way in which he helped me experience his country gave me a glimpse of the character of the Filipino people that I think many do not get a chance to experience. But what moved me the most, I think, were the words he shared with me one afternoon after a particularly intense day. He says, in this country we have only four choices. And he was speaking for those who are committed to working for justice. We can sell out, get a well-paying job, perhaps with a multinational, live a comfortable life, and try to ignore or forget. Or we can continue working and struggling for justice openly and be crushed. Or we can go underground. Or we can leave the country. And while these words were spoken before the overthrow of Marcos, one of the things I'm going to share with you today, I think, is that increasingly, again, that kind of statement is all too real for people working for justice in the Philippines. This man, by the way, happens to be in London right now working on a paper for Amnesty International about the death penalty in the Philippines. So at least he hasn't sold out yet. I think these three examples give some images, glimpses of the Philippine reality. But it's a reality that one can't understand without some understanding of the historical context again. So I need to, again, spend some time on that. So let me spend just a few minutes trying to look at the history of the Philippines. After Magellan claimed the Philippines in 1521, Spain ruled the island for nearly 400 years, really until the end of the 19th century. During that time, growing independence movements challenged what was left of Spain's empire, and especially during the end of the 19th century. U.S. commercial interests were pressing commercial interests pressed the U.S. to enter into the conflict between Spain and its colonies. And in December of 1898, Spain ceded the Philippines to the United States. Spain was defeated at that point, and so Philippines were ceded to the United States. Now, another long and bloody war followed as the Filipinos resisted yet another foreign power, and over 100,000 U.S. troops were sent to the Philippines. This was one of the biggest surprises for me as I began to study Philippine history. I hadn't caught that if I'd been taught it in my history. 100,000 U.S. troops were sent to the Philippines, and nearly 500,000 Filipinos lost their lives in a war that by 1902 had firmly established the United States as a colonial power in Asia. Yet it was a war that did spark considerable controversy at home. Formal independence was finally granted to the Philippines in 1946 after the United States regained the islands from the Japanese. And that skips over a whole bunch of history in there, which we're going to do, I'm sorry. But independence, even in 1946, was much more nominal than real. The U.S. government insisted on retaining special privileges for U.S. business, including trade concessions, ownerships of banks and industries, and 23 bases for the U.S. military. 23 bases in 1946. Now, in the 60s and 70s, then, U.S. privileges, these special privileges, came under attack again as nationalist sentiments intensified in the region. And the U.S. bases were being used against Vietnam. So during the Vietnam War, the U.S. bases were very important, and the nationalist sentiment in the country was reacting against that presence. Many Filipinos had demanded that the industry and the land be turned over to Filipino control. And as the economic conditions deteriorated then during that time, strikes against U.S. corporations and demonstrations against American bases, all of those things increased in the Philippines during the 60s and 70s. Even the Philippine Congress passed laws limiting ownership of businesses and land, and the Supreme Court threatened confiscation of U.S. property during that time. But then, in response, foreign business interests, primarily U.S., and wealthy families began calling for law and order. Isn't that always the way? When people get out of hand, call for law and order. And so then began to emerge the politics of internal repression that Marcos was so familiar with. On September 21st, 1972, Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law in the Philippines. He suspended the Constitution, dissolved Congress, and moved swiftly to close off all channels of dissent. He closed down universities and imprisoned thousands of students. He shut down 18 daily newspapers in Manila and instituted very tight control over the rest of the media. He transferred from civil to military courts all the crimes against the public order, which ranged from vagrancy to treason, virtually. He suspended the right of habeas corpus. He centralized the police into one national force. He repealed laws that Congress had just passed curbing foreign ownership of property. He reversed all of that. That was starting to happen a bit. And he passed a new constitution legitimizing his constitutional authoritarianism. That was his new role in the Philippines. And virtually, the institution of martial law closed down all opposition and opened the door once again to U.S. business and friendly relationships with the U.S. government. Other developments in the Philippines then, including a sharp increase in militarization and military spending, a growth of the armed resistance, which increasingly clashed with government troops, and a dramatic increase in U.S. military aid to the Philippines, and certainly also an increase in serious widespread human rights violations, including torture and government-sanctioned assassination. In 1981, after almost 10 years of this situation of martial law was lifted partly because of internal pressure and probably primarily, because martial law was really creating image problems for Marcos. And it's there, I think, we begin to pick up the story in this country a little bit. We begin to hear more about the Philippines. And it's at that point when that image is beginning to sour internationally. Martial law is lifted, and he needed to help those image problems because he was seeking more and more military and economic assistance from the United States. But utilizing various mechanisms during that time, Marcos managed to retain his decree-making powers, which meant that the lifting of martial law didn't really mean very much, and left the character of the Marcos regime essentially intact. And meanwhile, the conditions of the Filipino people continued to deteriorate. Virtually in the last days of the Marcos regime, virtually the entire political spectrum in the Philippines, from the illegal National Democratic Front to the traditional opposition political parties, was calling for an end to the Marcos dictatorship. Many grassroots organizations had formed to protest the government's involvement, and many churches were taking an increasingly prophetic role in that process. I want to sketch just very briefly the sort of the main actors in that political struggle in the Philippines, because they still are very relevant today. On the right, of course, was Marcos and his cronies, that's exactly how they're referred to, as his cronies. Which a very tight elite group of very wealthy people who essentially had the power in the country and controlled the military. Then were the traditional opposition parties. And these represent, it's out of this segment that really Cory Aquino comes and many of the others. Those are basically the landed people in the country, the wealthy people who had passed the political torch back and forth between them over the years, still representing a minority of the country. Then there was a large increasing group of what were referred to as cause-oriented groups. Groups who were trying to operate within the legal framework, such as it was in the Philippines. Many lawyers talked about it's impossible to practice law in a country where there is no law. But nevertheless, they were trying to operate within that legal framework. And these were some of the groups that were hardest hit by Marcos's repression, because they were operating openly and yet were being accused of being aligned with the left, the National Democratic Front, which was an alliance of actually many church, labor, and so forth groups, actually working for the overthrow of the Marcos regime, and with the armed wing of the National Democratic Front, which was referred to as the NPA, or the New People's Army. Now what you have today is, and what you saw during that period is many of the people in this sector were gradually moving over to the cause-oriented groups as Marcos's terror just became too much. With the overthrow of Marcos, you see this group coming firmly into power. And as we'll talk about in a bit, these groups coming still very marginalized. Let me stop there with the history for a moment and see if you have any questions. We'll pick up the revolution in the next phase, but anything on the history that I may be able to answer, may not.
Well, always so prominently mentioned is the communists. Where do they fit?
Okay, well, the NPA, one of the players in the NPA on the National Democratic Front is the Communist Party of the Philippines. They're not the only player, but they're one of the actors and probably one of the leading actors. It's very interesting because the Communist Party of the Philippines is very anti-Soviet. There is a party that really was... actually, Marcos had quite good relationships with the Soviet Union. And there's a party actually within this framework that is more the party that's aligned with the Soviet Union. The Communist Party of the Philippines, very anti-Soviet, probably has more closer connections to People's Republic of China in terms of its ideology and philosophy. Keep interjecting questions even as
are
I
there move other on. International countries involved besides the United States?
Well, Spain primarily, and there's certainly other in the early years, and there are certainly other multinational interests involved in the Philippines. Many other countries are there. It really has been, under Marcos, a wonderful place to do business, so to speak. But it's the U.S. presence is so predominant in the Philippines, I think more so than in many places that I've been, because of that historic... I mean, they were a colony of the U.S., right? Filipino people, many of them who were in the earlier days or older people, learned more U.S. history than they learned of their own Filipino history, because it was filtered through that kind of filter, see? And so the U.S. presence is by far the most dramatic. Now, all of this finally led to the February Revolution of 1986. Marcos had called what came to be known as snap elections. You may have heard that term used at the time, to try to cement his power. His opponent was Cory Aquino. Marcos planned to control the vote counting, or his plans to control the vote counting, as he had in the past, began to unravel very quickly after the election. The U.S. Embassy, for whom Marcos had finally become a liability, arranged for his departure, and Cory Aquino came to power. Now, that's oversimplifying it, but it's pretty close to what happened. And then the Filipinos lived happily ever after, right? Or as many would have us believe they did. And as many who were reporting the events of that time would have had us believe, even at the time. A good friend of mine is a journalist for the Minneapolis Star and Tribune, and he traveled with us to the Philippines just before the elections, and then he stayed on. And he said it was just amazing before that election. You'd come out of the Manila Hotel in the morning and there'd be just like floods of journalists, like lemmings to the sea. They'd either head for the Aquino campaign bus or they'd head for the Marcos campaign bus. And none of them would get out into the countryside and really understand what the people of the Philippines were thinking about this election and how they were reacting to it. And so what we got is that kind of reporting. Aquino wins and the Philippines is saved. Actually, many people representing a wide range of political viewpoints, including those on the left, did celebrate Cory's coming to power very tentatively and watched hopefully, though very skeptically, if she would follow through on her promises of really changing the status quo in the Philippines. 2.5 years later, for those who have really been struggling for change in the Philippines, it appears that skepticism was the more appropriate response than celebration. With Marcos gone, many thought the problems were solved. However, he left an economy in shambles. 70% of the population of 55 million lives in poverty, as I said. And as Cory Aquino came to power, she faced key issues concerning land reform, the future of U.S. military bases in the Philippines, and the war with the now 20,000 member strong New People's Army. She used some innovative approaches, especially early on, and there was some real hope early on. In December 86, she entered a ceasefire with the NPA, but she has not been able to deliver the changes which she promised, at least, and not enough to satisfy a significant number of Filipinos. And in fact, she has moved significantly to the right in her approach, and we'll look at some reasons why. I'd like to focus on a few of those areas that she promised to deliver in, and really it gives us a glimpse of what's happening in the Philippines today. First, the question of land reform. 10% of the population in the Philippines owns 90% of the land. 60% of Filipinos cultivate land they do not own. And these are tiny, tiny plots, most of them. The primary focus of Aquino's presidential campaign was land reform. And she had an unrepeatable opportunity to really fulfill that promise. Imagine if you were came into office as a president with this. She swept into a office with a mandate for serious change. I mean, everybody thought this was the time, with perhaps, you know, a few of a small sector that did not. 65% of the country in a number of polls favored land reform at the time of her coming to power. She enjoyed a national and international status that bordered on sainthood when she came to power. And you all remember that. She put land reform on the back burner, saying it was more urgent to set up a constitutional framework for democracy rather than to do land reform. And it's important to recognize in all this that Cory Aquino is a large landowner. Rather than taking leadership on this issue of land reform, she passed the buck to Congress, most of whom are also landowners. And finally, this past month, Congress passed a bill, that is the Philippine Congress, that is very unsatisfactory for most Filipino farmers. Among other things, it allows corporate farms to distribute capital stock to workers rather than land. That's not what they want. They want land. That's what's important, so they can have their own self-determination. And the land reform is set up in phases such that it will allow large landowners to subdivide their land among family members to minimize distribution. It's a typical tactic to avoid land reform. It's an interesting twist in the Filipino law. It even gets creative. It's part of this sort of farcical nature of the Philippines. It's specified in the law that it can be to legitimate or illegitimate heirs that you can divide the property. And finally, it's unclear how government will fund compensation. That hasn't been determined. Inevitably, disappointment with this new law will lead many peasants to land takeovers. We've seen that happen already in the last month or so in the Philippines. And more than a few landowners have said that they will defend their land with private armies. And many of them have their own private armies. So the conflict will simply escalate. With respect to U.S. military bases, this is an important, very important issue shaping events in the Philippines in the next couple of years. In 1991, the 40-year-old military bases agreement will expire. Okay, this will be the expiration of the military bases agreement. U.S. facilities are extensive. The Subic Naval Base, as I said, is the largest overseas naval installation. It's a supply depot for the 7th Fleet. The 13th Air Force is headquartered at Clark Field. The bases cover 192,000 acres in the Philippines and over 15,000 military personnel. Many consider the bases essential to U.S. security interests, and many consider them, Filipinos consider them important for the Philippines as well. They serve as a logistical center for the deployment of nuclear-armed naval units to the Indian Ocean. They are our center for that there. They are a training center for rapid deployment forces designed for military support in the Middle East. They protect U.S. military power to Southeast Asia, to the mainland of Southeast Asia and serve as a kind of counterpoint to Soviet forces in Da Nang. Now, this is all sort of U.S. military spokesmen speaking here in terms of the need for them. They are a backdrop for U.S. forces in Korea. And they provide alternate supply lines to Israel. It's an alternative route for supplying things to Israel. They're also big business. $500 million is brought into the Philippine economy each year because of the bases. $500 million of income into the Philippine economy. And they are the largest employer after the Filipino government. They're the largest employer in the Philippines next to the Filipino government. For the many in the Philippines, that's the U.S. position on it. For many in the Philippines, the bases constitute a very wonderful bargaining chip. The eviction threat is used as leverage to secure more aid for the Philippines. And Washington bristles when foreign aid to the Philippines is referred to as rent for the bases. But it's essentially what it is. And many Filipinos favor milking that threat for more U.S. dollars. Now, increasing numbers of Filipinos believe that eviction of the U.S. from the Philippines should be more than an idle threat, that the bases should be closed when the military bases agreement expires. Number one, they believe that bases violate their national sovereignty, that it gives them no control really over what happens in the Philippines, that it makes them a target for nuclear hostilities. Here we have our supply depot for nuclear weapons in the Pacific. What's going to be a first strike for any kind of nuclear confrontation? And there's a tremendous reaction against the kind of undesired social effects, the kind of a Longapo City stuff that I was talking about earlier. There's also, I think, there are many very creative thinking done about alternatives, because, of course, the first response is always, well, what about all those jobs? There's been some very creative work done on the idea of Subic Naval Base as a first-rate shipyard, and some plans being done for that. Now, that's not simple by any means, but nevertheless, there are alternative plans. There is very strong organization in the Philippines right now working for an end to the bases agreement. Many have been tortured and killed as a result of anti-bases work. And that's in the last 2.5 years. That's not before Marcos. It's quite possible, in fact, and the sentiment here is very unusual, because it's quite possible that Senate may pass, short of an anti-bases or a base eviction, they may pass an anti-nuclear law, which will make the Philippines a nuclear-free zone, which will create a very interesting crisis, it seems to me, with respect to what the U.S. does then with its nuclear weapons in Subic, which it, of course, will not say it has or does not have, but everyone agrees that it has. Some suspect that the U.S. will, of its own accord, by 1983 or 84, decide it's not worth it to be in the Philippines. Because a strike by the end, and one of the things that the Philippines is a communication center for all its network throughout Southeast Asia. The NPA hits one of its main communication towers, just one strike could shut down all communication for an hour, even an hour in Asia, in terms of our defense strategy, would be a tremendous blow. And the U.S. may find that it has to move out anyway. Finally, in the question of human rights, the first month of Aquino's government was a time of relative respect for human rights. There was some very good time then. But the situation has deteriorated dramatically, with some suggesting that the situation is as bad, if not worse, than during the Marcos era. And that was a real surprise to me. I was in the Philippines in early June, I guess. Yes, early June. And that, hearing that, was a tremendous surprise. People again and again saying, it's getting to the point where it's worse than the Marcos era. A particular concern are the growth of vigilante groups, which have had the tacit approval of the Aquino government and have been linked to assassination, cases of torture, and other human rights violations. In fact, Aquino has recently denounced a recent Amnesty International report as exaggerated and biased, which linked military, police, and vigilante groups to the killing of 74 people, specifically, very specific cases. These vigilante groups are said to be killing people who are allegedly sympathetic to the New People's Army. But nevertheless, the tactics are something less than one would expect in a democratic society. Anyone involved in organizing poor, working with base Christian communities, or working for human rights is a potential target now in the Philippines again. And it has become very serious. Many groups are starting to feel the need to go underground again. Even Cardinal Sin, with whom we met in June, defended some of these groups as only engaging in self-defense. And that was disturbing to hear. Let me give you an example of sort of the mood in the Philippines. An incident experienced by one of our groups last April in the Philippines. The group was in a restaurant in Bacolod in the province of Negros, which is an island in the central part of the Philippines. Men wearing camouflage fatigues and bearing rifles silently filed into the restaurant. The uniforms had no identification on them. Uniforms are supposed to have, you know, they have even some sort of identification, whether it's national police or army. When they stopped, they focused their attention on a man named Serge Cherniguin. And Serge is the Secretary General of the National Federation of Sugar Workers. He's the head of the National Sugar Workers Union in the country. And he's a leader in the national labor movement. There was a Canadian with Cherniguin, and five other Americans were at tables nearby. The armed men frisked someone else in the office. All the while, they had their eyes focused on Cherniguin. They frisked someone else and then filed silently out. And it's clear that those who analyzed that situation afterwards said it's clear that whatever their purpose had been, they decided not to carry it out because of the presence of North Americans in the room. So again, those people who are involved in organizing the poor in any way are once again feeling that pressure in the Philippines that they felt under Marcos. Some of these vigilante groups are gangs of corrupt local politicians, and others are private armies of landowners. And still others are composed of such fanatical cults as a group called Tad-Tad, which literally means in Tagalog, chop-chop. And they're a group that has been known to literally chop their victims to death. And they have been carrying out this kind of activity also in the last couple of years. They were very active in the pre-Marcos days, in the Marcos days. Now, the U.S. response to this is interesting. The U.S. Department describes these groups as, and I quote, unarmed neighborhood watch organizations which supplement police intelligence, unquote. But many are armed with bolo knives and homemade guns and even M16s. So what of U.S. policy then in general? There's not much question about U.S. policy during the Marcos era. Washington was one of Marcos's staunchest allies. And it was only when it was clear there was no way to keep him in power in any reasonable way did we desert him and turn our support to Aquino. I mean, we have to realize that happened very late in the game. The current strategy is one that has been a hallmark of our strategy in Central America as well. To pursue a two-track policy that gives strong public support for the Aquino government on the one hand, while at the same time establishing ties to right-wing and paramilitary networks to force the Philippine government further to the right. That's what I said before. As we see what has if we look at what's happened to Aquino over the last 2.5 years, I think this becomes very clear. Now, several events seem to point to the accuracy of that assertion about the direction of current U.S. policy in the Philippines. And let me just mention some of those that give evidence to that this, in fact, is what's happening. First is public acknowledgement. It's been acknowledged publicly that the Reagan administration, Reagan himself, signed a secret finding in 1987 approving a $10 million two-year plan for increased CIA involvement in the Philippines, and particularly involvement in the Philippine government's anti-insurgency campaign. This allowed the U.S. to increase its CIA agents in the Philippines to 130 and to launch undercover political activities as well as gather intelligence. Those phrases sound familiar, undercover political activities. Covert is another word that can be. A second factor that gives weight to this thesis is that is the so-called spontaneous proliferation of armed vigilante groups, these groups that I was talking about before. Ralph McGee, who's a former CIA officer who participated in the Phoenix operation in Vietnam, has said he found direct parallels between the Philippines' military counterinsurgency operations involving vigilante groups and those conducted by the U.S. during the Vietnam War. What were the characteristics of them? Both purified villages by assassinating suspected communists, both of those programs. Both have carried out search and destroy operations, created free fire zones, and forced people from rural areas to population centers in order to deny the insurgents a recruiting base, you know, separate the people from the enemy so the people, the enemy can't use the people, can't have that as a recruiting base. Those are at least a couple of the examples of the kind of similarities between what was carried out in Operation Phoenix and what's happening today in the Philippines. A third important piece of evidence for this role of the U.S. today is the presence and activity of retired Major General John Singlaub in the Philippines. Is that a familiar name to anyone? Singlaub has been active in destabilization efforts in Nicaragua and training anti-communist forces in Central America. He appears in very interesting places. He came to look for buried treasure, he says. That's why he came to the Philippines, to look for buried treasure. While there, he met with the defense minister, Juan Ponce Enrile. He met with U.S. embassy officials. He met with the CIA station chief in Manila and members of the Aquino cabinet, all in his pursuit of buried treasure. He also recruited 37 Vietnam War veterans to train Philippine soldiers in counterinsurgency. So he's very active in the Philippines and carrying out someone's will, at least. A fourth factor has been the appearance of right-wing religious and humanitarian groups also in the Philippines. Those have begun to proliferate also in the years since the overthrow. One has been is CAUSA, the political arm of the Unification Church, the Moonies. The wife of the vice president of the Philippines is the president of the Philippine chapter of CAUSA. And for many of you who are familiar with CAUSA, know they have a very, very clear political agenda. An article in the Manila Chronicle in October reported, and I quote from that article, "American conservatives are setting up private aid projects to help Philippines fight communist insurgency. Such aid parallels private efforts by U.S. conservative groups in Central America, a la Ali North and company." And a fifth, I think, evidence for what is happening in the Philippines and the U.S. behind support to it is the sudden jump in a sophisticated, in the sophistication of anti-communism communist materials used with church and other groups, the kind of sophistication that's being used. Activist priests, for example, last year, and these are priests that are involved in base Christian community work in the Philippines, which is also very active there as in Central America, received a packet of info from the armed forces of the Philippines, including the Cardinal Ratzinger's instruction on certain aspects of a theology of liberation. And those of you who know, Cardinal Ratzinger is the Vatican's chief spokesperson for dealing with liberation theology and has been very, very critical of it. Another example, the U.S. Information Service Director in Davao City, Larry Schwartz, sent a glossy full-color magazine on U.S. bases to school teachers in the Davao area, requesting that they share with their pupils the list of schools and roads in Davao City which were built with funds associated with the bases agreement. So there's very sophisticated kinds of stuff that's being done to push this policy. Let me say one last thing and then open it to you. What we see at play in the Philippines, I think, are the essential components of the doctrine of low-intensity conflict. And I'm going to talk more about that on Saturday, but just to give you a little a taste of that. And what are those ingredients? This is not something accidental. This is very clearly planned strategy. Number one, sophisticated use of communication, economic aid, and civic action to create a favorable image of the Philippine military and of the U.S. Secondly, a reliance on civil defense forces to supply intelligence and discourage civilians from supporting the NPA. Thirdly, intense aerial bombing in remote regions, and that's, we're seeing that again, very much like in El Salvador. A proliferation of TV movies and strident that have a strident anti-communist tone. And finally, the what's referred to as the war at home, keeping U.S. public unaware of the region's conflict. And perhaps this is the most serious. Most North Americans have heard little about the vigilante groups in the Philippines today. I mean, virtually nobody's heard much about them. And they have still, we still have images here of the February Revolution, or the Feb Rev, as it's called in the Philippines, and is of a president who freed many political prisoners. We still have a very positive image of Cory Aquino. I think it is clear that it's indeed time to take the Philippines very seriously. There are the struggle for trying to achieve some kind of democracy in the Philippines is one that's being carried on every day, and is a very represents millions and millions of Filipino people who do not support the kind of directions, at least, that it appears the Aquino government is moving. I'm afraid, with our help. All right, let me stop and let you at it a bit. We have at least 10 minutes. Yes, sir.
If the land reform had gone through at the time that Cory Aquino had the opportunity, what sort of difference do you think that would have made?
Well, I think it would have taken more than just the land reform, right? It would have been a very important first step. She really had an unbelievable, I mean, people who I thought would never support, who were very, very much so anti-Marcos, who were strongly supporting what the NPA is doing, were saying, we want to give her a chance. You know, she had a mandate like I don't think we've ever seen a president have a mandate. And if she would have begun to, if she would have really carried through with land reform in a serious way initially, if she would have really kind of, she had, during her campaign, she had talked quite a bit about the bases and how they were not helpful to sovereignty. If she had really carried through on some of that, I think she would have a very strong role in the Philippines today. She did start, in fact, she her amnesty with the ceasefire with the NPA was a remarkable step, and I think had the potential for really bringing together that society. Now the question becomes, what stopped the process? I think, Jim, you first and then over here.
The problem was, wasn't the problem, well, how was she going to implement it? Because the infrastructure had all Marcos cronies in the whole country, and as did the army.
That's right.
She did not have any political structure with which to implement
that. I think you're right. I think there is a little bit of what's been referred to here as the Duarte syndrome. That here was a person elected to power who did not really have control of the military. There are those who said, though, if she would have acted quickly at the right time, that she could have put people in the power of those institutions that would have put them under her control. And some people make that argument. So there really is a sense in which she did not have the kind of control of the infrastructure that allowed her to carry that out. But again, one can't underestimate the popular support that she had during those first few months. And the momentum of that revolution, I mean, if we want to call it a revolution, but the momentum of that those times, that I think had she taken some firm steps at that point, she might have been able to pull that power around here. But that's a debatable question, I think.
But she did disappoint
I mean, all the Marcos people were immediately put out of jobs.
Right.
And were replaced by a group of appointees. In other words, there was an attempt.
Yeah, but there were some key places where she didn't, namely the military, you know. And some say she could have, that she should have at that point.
Do you think she was co-opted because of Enrile and Ramos's having swung over at the last minute?
Well, I think that certainly didn't, it made her, put her in a difficult position to throw them out. But I think what was also so key here, and it's important for us to recognize, is the involvement of the U.S. Embassy in this thing from the very minute it happened. Who provided the transportation for Marcos to get out of the country? It was amazing to me to sit in Cardinal Sin's office last month and hear him talk about the phone calls that went back and forth between he and Ambassador Bosworth at the very moment that this thing was happening. That, who was really orchestrating exactly what was going on here. And so I think we can't underestimate the role that the U.S. Embassy played, even from the very beginning, in trying to shape how the outcome of those events. I was amazed to hear him saying those things at that moment. You had a question?
I was just echoing what the gentleman over there said with the fact that Enrile and Ramos jumped over at the last minute.
Right.
And then the fact that she's had, three attempted coups on her?
Yeah,
so,
right.
Would she have lived?
Yeah. But see, part of the issue, many raised the question about those coups as well. The kind of superstructure that they've needed to succeed, where are they getting their support? Are those simply independent, isolated things? Or are they another thing that's attempting to push her to make sure she stays in line, to stay in line with what needs to be the policy? No, I don't think so. It's been a while if he was. He isn't one of the more recent ones in El Salvador. Well, I think the administration believes that it can be kept under control with low-intensity conflict, or maybe even there's some image that it can be stopped or lessened. My own opinion is that it can't, and that in much what we're seeing with El Salvador today, I think it'll be a longer process in the Philippines, but that it has a certain inevitability about it of being a real continuation of that kind of death and suffering for many, many years to come. At least that's my image of it at this point. I think the hopefulness of those first months after the Aquino is really gone in the Philippines right now. I didn't see much of it when I was there.
I was astounded that
Well, I think that's, you know, that I suppose we will never know until something like the Christic Institute can really present its case. But it certainly is one of the characteristics of many who have written about low-intensity conflict, those who have helped design it. We have here a private citizen, right? But the relationship of private citizens to those who are controlling power in the country to carry out certain objectives that the government cannot carry out. I mean, we've seen that in Ali North, there was not a private citizen, but the network of private citizens that was used in that kind of operation. Singlob's just as active as he's ever been. Hunting treasure.
Buried
treasure yet.
Yeah.
Joy. Well, I think there, obviously, as you can imagine, the Filipino population in this country represents the spectrum of opinion, the same spectrum it does in the country. But there are many, there is quite a very strong organization of Filipino people in this country working precisely for, particularly on the basis question. You know, the real problem is, I think, is that in all of this is the remoteness of the Philippines from our consciousness and the importance of the American people. It's not something we write to our congressperson about. This friend of mine who I mentioned was working on the paper in London for Amnesty International wrote and asked a letter asking if, do you think there can be any interest generated in the U.S. to support an anti-capital punishment? capital punishment was abolished in the Philippines, and now there's a movement to resurrect it again. It was abolished with the end of the Marcos era. And he said, can you generate any interest in the U.S. to organize around capital punishment in the Philippines? I said, my God, we can't even do it in our own country, right? How, it's enough to get people aware that the Philippines exists, let alone to organize over that kind of issue. And many Filipinos in the Philippines are not very realistic about that, about what we can do. Filipinos in this country, I think, see better the reality that they're up against, and so do pick particular issues. And one of those is the basis. And so I think in concert with other North Americans, there is some activity on that. I'm skeptical on that, though, as well. I mean, I think the Subic Naval Base is perceived to be so important that we'll do just about anything to keep it there until we determine that it's not necessary. There are many people, strategically, who believe that Subic Base is outdated and that, that there are plans, in fact, to move it to Palau in the Micronesia. Poor Micronesians, but nevertheless, there is, and many in the military believe that's a better idea anyway. Yes, you and then from here.
Yeah, just one thing on the bases. When I was in Bangkok, there was a lot of interest in the ASEAN nations, and the general mm-hmm. thing in the press there was that the ASEAN nations are very concerned about these bases because if we move out, there's a power vacuum. Who they see will either be filled by the Russians, which are, or mm-hmm. which they fear more than the Russians, is the Japanese
yeah.
power moving there. And so there's a lot of interest for these countries to keep the bases.
Right.
So it's more just a U.S.
No, there is. There certainly is. But again, I think there are alternatives within even the framework of saying we need to keep that military presence. There are many other options that, and given the fact of any more 2 or 3 day sailing time doesn't mean much. In terms of what it has for our national defense, you know, or whoever's national defense.
I was just wondering if, almost ironically, the naval bases there would impede the successful low intensity conflict battle. Like in Nicaragua, it's hard to draw the ties because we're so removed. But if there's that big of a U.S. naval basis, I wonder if it would almost be easier to see, it would be harder to mask it over with that media and public relations business that they do now with Nicaragua. You see what I'm saying?
I think so, except low-intensity conflict, sort of the last priority of many is direct involvement of U.S. forces, yeah. If I understand what you're getting at.
Yeah.